Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Joanne Mariner of Human Rights Watch, who discusses the leak of a secret Red Cross report documenting the torture of U.S.-held prisoners and growing pressure on the Obama administration to open an investigation. Kurt Gehring of Amnesty International USA, who examines the legality of Israel's use of American-supplied weapons in their December assault on Gaza, which killed an estimated 1,400 Palestinians. And Katie Robbins of Healthcare Now, who talks about her group's campaign to push for universal healthcare reform in the U.S. under a government single-payer model. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The call for fiscal responsibility in the federal budget, as deficit spending surges to counter the deep recession, could in coming years, argues The Nation magazine, force the Obama administration to undermine its commitment to Social Security. The threat comes from the movement for entitlement reform pushed by billionaire activist Pete Peterson and other Wall Street players who want to cap Social Security and Medicare benefits. Social Security, which has produced surpluses since a 1983 increase in the payroll tax, will be solvent to at least 2041. The problem is that the cash surplus in Social Security has been used to fund other government programs and hide government deficits. Reimbursement to Social Security in order to fund the payments of benefits could be done by selling more government bonds or extending the tax on Social Security beyond the current $107,000 ceiling. To deal with the looming entitlement crisis, Peterson relies on a joint report from the Brookings Institution and the Heritage Foundation that calls on Congress to put budget caps on entitlement programs that might trigger budget and benefit cuts to recipients of Social Security and Medicare. While Social Security is currently solvent, the current financial meltdown points to a looming retirement savings crisis. 401k retirement accounts have deflated, and many companies have stopped matching employee contributions. A proposed progressive alternative to current retirement programs would be a government-guaranteed pension plan that would be managed as a nonprofit. New School economist Teresa Ghilarducci estimates such a national pension plan combined with Social Security would guarantee 70% of pre-retirement earnings. Civil unions in France, officially known as civil solidarity PACs or simply PACs, are growing increasingly popular with heterosexual couples. The civil PACs were established in 1999 to provide gay couples legal rights. But the law passed under a socialist government never made any references to homosexuals. Now, the vast majority of PACs go to heterosexual couples, where they enjoy most of the tax advantages of marriage and can easily dissolve their civil unions. According to the Washington Post, conservatives now in power in France fiercely opposed the creation of civil solidarity PACs in 1999. But Conservative Party President Nicolas Sarkozy now backs civil unions and acted to extend marriage-like tax benefits to PACs when he served as finance minister in an earlier administration. Today, public employees like schoolteachers have an incentive to enter into civil unions as they are eligible for transfer to teach in the same city. The Food and Drug Administration called for a rapid recall of pistachio nuts in light of growing evidence of salmonella contamination at a large California food processing plant. The FDA insisted on a recall after Kraft Foods reported in late March that it found salmonella in pistachios in routine testing, prompting the food giant to recall several trail mixes. This food recall comes 3 months after the recall of peanut butter, which was contaminated at a Georgia peanut butter processing plant. The salmonella outbreak in peanut butter led to 9 deaths. The Los Angeles Times reports that Congress is now debating ways to improve food safety standards, including giving the FDA the power to issue mandatory recalls of tainted foods. There is another proposal to split up the FDA and establish a new Food Safety Administration. Kathleen Sebelius, President Obama's nominee for Secretary of Health and Human Services, in her confirmation hearing, downplayed the need to break up the FDA. Instead, Sebelius, the former governor of Kansas, said she wanted to transform the FDA into a world-class regulatory agency. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.
The International Committee of the Red Cross issued a confidential report in 2007 on interrogation abuse that their monitors documented at U.S. CIA-run secret prisons. The report condemned America's treatment of 14 high-value terrorist suspect detainees held at so-called black sites as inhuman, violating U.S. and international law. The report remained secret until it was made public in early April by writer and journalism professor Mark Danner on the New York Review of Books website. The Red Cross noted that apart from subjecting prisoners to waterboarding, U.S. interrogators with the apparent authorization from the Bush administration had exposed detainees to extreme temperatures, beaten them, and deprived them of food. In addition, prisoners had recounted how they were threatened with electric shock, infection with HIV/AIDS, sodomy, and violence against family members. Spanish judge Baltasar Garzón, who indicted Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet when he visited London in 1998, has launched a new investigation of six former Bush administration officials for their alleged criminal authorization of torture. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Joanne Mariner, director of Human Rights Watch's Terrorism and Counterterrorism Program. She discusses the importance of the Red Cross report and how it adds to the growing worldwide pressure on the Obama administration to open up an investigation and prosecute Bush administration officials who may be guilty of war crimes.
The importance of the report is that the Red Cross had access to the 14 so-called high-value detainees who were transferred from CIA custody to Guantanamo in September 2006. And these were people, some of whom had been held literally for many years. I mean, the first one was picked up in, I believe it was January 2002. So they'd been held more than 4 years, some of them, at the time they were transferred to Guantanamo. And no one who's spoken to them has been able to make public what these detainees had to say about their treatment. So right now they have access to counsel, but these counsel are under gag orders, and they're unable to. Their notes have to be declassified, and their notes aren't declassified. So I was down at Guantanamo a few months ago watching them in court, and there's a 20-second delay. So if they say anything that the CIA does not want to be made public, it's censored. The sound is cut, and you don't hear. So this report is the first glimpse we've had at these guys and what the Red Cross found, and of course they're very, very authoritative in issuing these findings, is that these men were subject to severe forms of torture. The CIA report clearly uses the word torture. It uses the word inhuman treatment, cruel treatment, and it goes into detail about how these men were treated. They were waterboarded, some of them, at least three of them. They were beaten. They were hung up by their arms for days at a time, stopped from sleeping, sexually humiliated, held naked for months. Just sort of basic kind of, you know, fairly medieval forms of torture. And this is an authoritative report that makes those findings and now makes them publicly.
We have Leon Panetta, Obama's new director of the CIA, who asserts that no one who participated in this torture and abuse should be investigated or prosecuted. What's your take on that? How do you react to the assertion, without any real contradiction from President Obama himself, that these torturers, whoever they are, and presumably not just those in the cells performing the torture, but those who ordered it above, should be beyond the reach of the law?
Well, it's, of course, very disappointing. And it is somewhat in contradiction with the idea that we don't want these abuses to occur again, because just, you know, generally the criminal justice system is based on a principle of deterrence. So when you punish something, that's how you ensure that it doesn't happen. When people know they're going to be punished, if these CIA interrogators thought they were going to go to jail, they wouldn't have carried out these abuses. So if we want to prevent them in the future, we don't just turn the page and, you know, provide amnesty to everyone and not even require any kind of truth-telling process. What we do is we carry out investigations and we prosecute people. And I think, you know, more importantly than the interrogators themselves, what the Obama administration is doing is letting the Bush administration and the senior officials who ordered these abuses off the hook. Because, you know, nobody looks at the interrogator as the main culprit. The main culprit are the people who formulated these policies, who decided to go down this route and who made orders, sent orders down the chain of command and, you know, told these interrogators to treat detainees in this way. And the high-level Bush administrations could have made very different choices and should have made very different choices.
Do you think the combination of this leaked Red Cross report on torture and the Spanish prosecutor, Baltasar Garzon, and his initiating an investigation of the six former Bush administration legal advisors, architects of the U.S. torture policy, will that put sufficient pressure on the Obama administration to change course and actively pursue an investigation and prosecution if warranted, do you think?
I think both the report and now the idea of possible Spanish prosecutions do create some pressure. And, you know, there's other things that are going to be happening in the future that I think will create additional pressure. There's a Senate Armed Services Committee report. The executive summary of it was issued last December, but it's a very long and, you know, comprehensively documented report and very, very critical. And it essentially finds Donald Rumsfeld and others are responsible for war crimes. So that report will create additional pressure. There is another report by the Office of Professional Responsibility that destroys the reasoning of the legal memos that tried to justify torture and finds that the authors of those memos were responsible for, you know, serious malpractice, essentially. And I think, you know, your listeners should be pressuring members of Congress to look at what happened and to analyze it and, you know, bring out the truth to the public and let a real public debate begin.
That was Joanne Mariner, Director of the Terrorism and Counterterrorism Program at Human Rights Watch. Contact the group by calling area code 212-290-4700 or visit their website at hrw.org. In late December of last year, a ship loaded with weapons departed the U.S. bound for Israel while George W. Bush was still president. A Pentagon spokesperson confirmed that it arrived in Israel on March 22nd, after Barack Obama took office. The spokesperson said that the shipment was destined for a U.S. pre-positioned ammunition stockpile in Israel. Under a U.S.-Israeli agreement, munitions from this stockpile may be transferred for Israel to use if necessary. This weaponry is part of the $3 billion in annual U.S. aid to Israel, most of it for military assistance. Amnesty International USA followed this shipment and contacted both the former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and the incoming Secretary of State Hillary Clinton to express concern that Israel was using U.S.-supplied weapons against Palestinians in ways that violated a number of U.S. laws. The latest instance was Israel's three-week-long air and ground assault on Gaza that began on December 27th, which killed an estimated 1,400 Palestinians, including 300 children and hundreds of other civilians. An Obama State Department official told Amnesty International that Israel's use of U.S. weapons during the Gaza conflict is under review to determine if Israel complied with U.S. law, but no conclusion has yet been reached. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Kurt Gehring, Senior Deputy Executive Director of Amnesty International USA, who talks about the U.S.-Israel military agreement and what steps concerned Americans could take to raise the issue with their elected officials.
Our concern was that even though this is said to have been destined for U.S. pre-positioning, its availability in Israel at this particular time, and particularly since it was leaving at the time or just before the fighting in Gaza escalated this time around, that it might be used in that fighting, and that in any case the signal that is sent by the U.S. Shipping this large, massive quantity of munitions to Israel at this particular time certainly didn't give the impression that the U.S. had any concerns about how that weaponry might be used. Certainly there's ample evidence of the use of U.S. Weaponry, all kinds of it in Gaza, that was misused in highly populated civilian areas. We've gathered information about that, including physical evidence and photographs. So there seems to be no question that this equipment was used irresponsibly and in ways that may have constituted violations of international law, including war crimes.
Well, could Obama have stopped the shipment since he became president 2 full months before it was delivered to Israel?
At the time Obama was inaugurated, this particular shipment hadn't been delivered. So, you know, presumably, had there been a very clear, unequivocal message from the new president that the U.S. would, after all, respect its own laws and its own regulations relating to the provision of weaponry to countries whose forces engage in serious human rights violations, and there are several such regulations, then I think that would have sent a very clear signal that the new president was not in agreement with the use of U.S. Weaponry to further the violations that were at that time already amply documented.
In Gaza, you mean?
In Gaza, that's right.
But no sitting U.S. president has ever accused Israel of human rights violations. You know, instead, the U.S. position has always been that Israel is just defending itself.
That's right. I mean, there are some very clear laws that we believe apply in situations like this. The section of the U.S. Foreign Assistance Act, you know, which states that the United States won't be supplying weaponry to countries that engage in a consistent pattern of human rights violations, would be one of those. Another is the Arms Export Control Act, and a third is the Leahy Law, which forbids the provision of aid to security forces which engage in violations. But, you know, the president or the president-elect at that time wouldn't needed to have gone that far. He could simply have raised the question about how is this shipment consistent with U.S. law? Or, you know, has there been a determination already made by the Pentagon that this weaponry isn't being used to further human rights violations in Gaza? So the president could have simply raised questions, and that would have sent a very strong signal.
Kurt Gehring, is Amnesty International asking Americans to take any action if they oppose this military aid to Israel that's being used in this way?
Yes, we are. We are asking the public and concerned individuals to write to our Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, and simply ask the questions about how these continued shipments of U.S. weaponry is consistent with U.S. law. Ask the question, has the president determined that despite the evidence that exists of the use of this weaponry to commit serious violations of international law, has the president determined that nonetheless there are extraordinary circumstances that exist which allow for the circumvention of the law? They could ask their own member of Congress, their elected representatives in both the House and the Senate, because Congress has been notoriously unengaged on this particular issue. What is Congress doing to monitor the implementation of the laws that it itself has passed and holds the administration responsible to uphold? Congress isn't doing its work in this area either.
That was Kurt Gehring of Amnesty International USA. Contact Amnesty at area code 212-807-8400 or visit their website at amnestyusa.org. During his campaign for the White House, Barack Obama was an advocate of national health care reform with the goal of universal medical coverage for all Americans, of whom 49 million are without health insurance. On the campaign trail, Obama was often quoted as saying, if he were starting from scratch, he would probably support a government-run single-payer system, but went on to say that because of the existing infrastructure, he would settle for improvements to the current privatized insurance system. The group Healthcare Now doesn't accept President Obama's concession to the current system. Believing that healthcare is a human right, not a privilege tied to the ability to pay, Healthcare Now is spearheading a national campaign to push for the passage of single-payer healthcare legislation known as the National Health Insurance Act, or H.R. 676. sponsored by Representative John Conyers, a Democrat of Michigan. The bill would, in essence, extend the current Medicare system to all citizens regardless of their age. A coalition comprised of healthcare activists, small businesses, faith organizations, labor unions, doctors and nurses, Healthcare Now has organized demonstrations, public forums, and lobbying to overcome the private insurance industry's well-financed effort to exclude the single-payer option from the national debate on healthcare reform. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Katie Robbins, Assistant National Coordinator for Healthcare Now. She talks about the advantages of single-payer and the obstacles that stand in the way of getting a fair hearing for the model used for the provision of health care in most industrialized nations of the world.
Currently, our health care system is failing, and that's something that maybe many of your listeners agree with, but just to highlight some of the problems that we face with our health care system so that we understand the importance of 676 is that we have a huge number of uninsured people in this country, 49 million, and an additional 14,000 are losing their insurance every day since this economic downturn. And in addition, a huge number of bankruptcies are due to medical debt. In fact, 50% of all bankruptcies are because of medical debt, and 70% of those bankruptcies had insurance at the time of illness. Children in many parts of the country today who are born today have a shorter life expectancy than their parents. And it's really phenomenal to wrap your mind around the actual number of people who die because they don't have health insurance. 18,000 to 22,000 people die each year because they don't have health insurance. And that does not happen in any other industrialized country in the world. So with H.R. 676, it takes Medicare, a system that has worked for over 40 years in this country, providing comprehensive care to people over 65 years of age. And it improves that system, because Medicare admittedly does have some problems, and expands it to everyone. So we call that a single-payer system because that refers to essentially the financing of our health care. A single-payer national health insurance system would be a public agency that organizes the health financing. But the delivery of care remains private, so it's still privately run doctors and hospitals. H.R. 676 is comprehensive in the care that it provides. Essentially, all medically necessary care will be covered. That's including doctor, hospital, long-term care, mental health, dental, vision, prescription drug, and medical supply costs. And people might ask, well, how do we cover comprehensive care for everyone under a single-payer system? Well, it's through the cost savings by removing the waste of the private insurance industry. The private health insurance industry is responsible for wasting up to a third of our healthcare dollars on administrative costs, on CEO salaries, profits, anything but healthcare. And that's the key. Removing the private insurance industry and those profit motives will provide enough cost savings to extend comprehensive coverage to everyone in this country. And that's what the single-payer movement is calling for, a real debate on what is the role of private insurance in our healthcare? What are they doing? We know we need doctors and hospitals to survive. Do we need a private health insurance industry? And the answer from the single-payer perspective is no, we don't.
Well, the insurance industry, of course, has a lot of clout in Washington, D.C. and around the rest of the country. They have enormous amounts of money to push their agenda, and they, of course, don't want to see themselves go extinct, so they're fighting this tooth and nail, and they've pretty much succeeded in excluding single-payer as an option from the debate, have they not?
It's been disappointing. The single-payer movement certainly has worked hard for the small successes we have seen in the debate thus far in the current administration, but you're absolutely right that it's an incredible amount of energy and money the industry is able to expend to keep their failed policies in place. And we really suspect that we haven't seen anything yet. There's some murmurings of a multi-million dollar campaign with TV commercials circulating. But the big argument that is so frustrating that they're able to tout is they say, you know, you don't want government making healthcare decisions for you when it should be up to the doctor and the patient. But today we know it's not the doctor and the patient making these decisions. It's the insurance companies. So we have this corporate bureaucracy and this corporate greed that has a stranglehold over our medical system. And the single-payer movement has been trying to expose that.
What is President Obama's position as of right now? What does he want to do with health care? Is it clear yet what direction he might want to take health care reform?
Yeah, Obama's position is interesting. It has evolved over the past 5 years, really. When he was campaigning, he did say if we were starting from scratch, he would support a single-payer system. But he is now touting that we need to build on what we have. He did campaign on the idea of a public option competing with private insurance. But it's really not clear what his position is. He did issue a number of principles that he wants healthcare reform to match up to and has sort of left the details to Congress. So we're not sure exactly what the reform will look like. There's definitely going to be a legislative battle, and I think that there's a spectrum of policies that are on the table, if you will, ranging from the idea of mandating the purchase of insurance for all individuals in this country, which is one of the most regressive ways to provide a national healthcare system. That's actually the model that is being used in Massachusetts right now. And they're claiming it, touting this mandate model as a success. Something like 98% of people are covered, but other reports are showing that it's much less. But many of these flaws are not being talked about in mainstream media. So we're still out here calling for the single-payer perspective to be involved in all congressional hearings and a Congressional Budget Office a report, and that's really the strength that the single-payer movement has right now is demanding a fair debate.
That was Katie Robbins, Assistant National Coordinator for Healthcare Now. Contact the group at 1-800-453-1305 or visit their website at healthcare-now.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Ruben Abreu, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.